91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. What does it mean to be different? Today, we examine the double edge of what are commonly referred to as mental illnesses or learning disabilities. Are they an impediment to success or the basis for it? Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman. We visit with psychiatrist and author Dr. Gail Saltz. Her latest book is The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. She argues that failing to properly nurture children with cognitive differences and seeing them as problems fails those children as well as our society by denying industry to these potentially brilliant leaders and innovators. We'll learn more in moments coming up on Topical Currents after the news. Welcome back to Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Bonnie Berman with you. Joseph Cooper on vacation. He'll return Monday. Why are some people with mental health challenges able to achieve greatness in spite of being labeled different? But is it in spite of or because of those very challenges or so-called disabilities that many are able to triumph in extraordinary ways? Joining us now is Dr. Gail Saltz. She's a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell School of Medicine, and a psychoanalyst with the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. Her latest book is The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. Dr. Gail Saltz joins us from New York. Welcome to you, Doctor.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Let's just set the stage to begin with. Tell us what illnesses or disabilities we're speaking of here when you use the word different.
Well, first of all, let me say, I use the word different and the word throughout brain differences really to help people understand that to some degree we all have somewhat different wiring. The idea, which I think has been in place for quite a while, that your brain is either normal or abnormal, you know, that there's a structure, everybody's structure or connections look the same, and if they don't, then you have a disease, is really not accurate. There is tremendous variation amongst brain wiring in people. But sometimes the wiring becomes, let's say, different enough or extreme enough in some arena that you may present with what I would say are symptoms. And I really divide the book up by chapter by symptoms because that's more what people relate to than a, quote, diagnosis, which is really my profession's way of putting sort of people in a box and being able to have clinicians speak with one another and clinicians speak with insurance companies and so on. But it's not as useful to people out there who are more likely to experience, have an experience that feels like a symptom. So the symptoms that I address are the ones that are most common for people. They range from anxieties of different sorts to attentional problems of certain sorts. People probably have heard the term attention deficit disorder, but difficulty concentrating or impulsivity. Mood issues, whether that's low mood or cycling mood, which people may have heard the term bipolar disorder, but having episodes of being very high mood and then alternating with low mood. Difficulty relating to others, which people may understand often fits in the autism spectrum in some way. Psychotic issues and like a break with reality in certain kinds of ways, and learning issues or difficulty learning in certain arenas, the most common of which is dyslexia or difficulty reading.
So really you cover the whole gamut here.
I do. I mean, there will be, believe me, I have heard from people who are like, why didn't you cover some very particular area? I tried to cover the spectrum of problems that people suffer that are probably most common, and of course there will be a few that I've missed.
Now, are we talking about structural differences in the brain when you talk about wiring? Are we talking about structural differences in the brain or differences in how we're able to process information or the brain is able to process information?
So the interesting thing is that the answer to that is both, because the way that the brain processes information, which is essentially a neuron, a nerve, right, passing a chemical to another nerve, and that being the message, that the communication from one nerve to the next, And nerves are, of course, what make up structure in the brain, plus these pathways, what I refer to as the wiring, but these pathways from structure to structure, it's all nerve-based, if you will. And so people tend to think, well, did I think that or feel that, or is it something in the structure? And really, structure is function. So what you think and feel and experience, that is, those are your structures and the wiring and how they are connected to each other and how they message to one another. Probably most of the differences exist in essentially wiring or pathways from one structure to another, but clearly there still are some differences potentially between from person to person in structure as well. But all of this comes together, and the variations in this come together to make us all the individuals that we are in terms of what we think and feel and experience. And sometimes if, for instance, a chemical and a pathway is not the same as, let's say, the majority. I'll just use this as a for instance. If a certain area that has to do with mood and the wiring therein has less, let's say, serotonin, a neurotransmitter, than a lot of people have, then you might experience low mood. And that's why sometimes medications are used to treat that. But also, and this is important, psychotherapy changes chemical and structure and wiring so that experiences we have, things we say to one another, and things that might happen in psychotherapy because they are experiences and they are talking, those also change structure and function, which is why therapy can really make permanent changes that work.
Wow, that's scientifically been proven that actually the psychoanalysis or psychotherapy can change. So it's not necessarily what you're born with. You can actually change the wiring and structure of your brain?
Oh, yes. The fact is that your environmental experiences, to some degree, are changing the structure and function of your brain all the time. And what's important and what I try to point out in each of these symptoms that can be a problem is that, to some degree, the earlier one intervenes, the better the chance of sort of stabilizing and reversing that symptom and staving off that symptom from recurring in the future. Because the younger you are, the more plastic your brain is, meaning the more changeable it is. So in childhood, you know, our brains aren't really fully developed even until our early 20s. But thereafter, the brain still stays plastic, meaning it still changes, and experience does change that. So yes, one might be born with the predisposition for a certain type of brain, which is why some of these problems run genetically in families. They have a biologic predisposition. But genes turn off and on based on environmental experiences. And so even though you have a certain biology, that keeps being morphed to some degree or changing to some degree based on the experiences one has. And that could be a negative experience like trauma, which can negatively impact the brain, but it can be positive experiences, learning experiences, school experiences, therapy experiences. And so to some degree, for example, I talk about dyslexia. You know, if you can be taught to read, actually, if you have dyslexia and can't read, but the way that you will learn to read is not the same as someone who is biologically primed to learn to read and learn to read in those developmental windows where it was meant to happen. So they use maybe a different part of the brain, and you can see that on imaging, rerouting of what is happening activity-wise when someone with dyslexia reads. It's different. But then on the flip side, and this is what the book is really about,
right,
the same wiring that may cause that problem in having difficulty learning to read because you have dyslexia also seems to confer the ability to have a wider spatial attention than other people, better visual spatial relations than people who don't have dyslexia, certain enhanced ability for creativity that people with dyslexia, without dyslexia, don't have. And so, for example, a woman that I speak about in the book, Dr. Beryl Benesaraf, who has pretty significant dyslexia. It's really still a struggle for her to read, and she tends to rely more on graphs and charts and visual input. She is also the doctor that discovered how to diagnose Down syndrome in fetuses in utero, because she could see things on X-ray and on ultrasound that other people without dyslexia really could not see.
It's really amazing, her story, actually, how she even got into medical school.
Yeah.
You know?
Which might probably might not happen today. You
right.
know, I mean, right. in the earlier days, right, the idea, and I think it also is a testament to the reality, which is that that IQ or intelligence is completely separate from pretty much all of these issues, but dyslexia included, so that sadly, in her day, people with dyslexia were just thought to be dumb or stupid or, you know, really and never going to be able to do well. But many people with dyslexia are extraordinarily intelligent. They can't read in the same way that maybe you, if you don't have dyslexia, and I can read. But that has nothing to do with their intellectual capacity. And in fact, Dr. Benisaraf is very, very bright.
So the person who's suffering greatly from some aspect of their wiring, you're saying, has a strength that's as hardwired as the dyslexia, and both need to be recognized as such. Is that true?
So, exactly. I am saying that. So, for instance, in attention deficit disorder, which has to do with the diagnosis itself, which has to do with difficulty concentrating, particularly on things that are not very interesting, a certain amount of impulsivity and high energy, and also comes with this disinhibition of thought. And in the brain, what's going on is something called sort of a faulty switch in an area called the default network, which is an area of great wiring connection. And in people who don't have attention deficit disorder, you can decide when you want to concentrate and kind of when you don't want to concentrate, more or less. But for somebody with ADD, that switch is broken, and so it's not that they can't concentrate, it's that they can't decide they want to concentrate, and so it has to be something that's so engaging, like for boys, a video game, or for Einstein, physics. And then if something really captures their attention, they can focus better than somebody who doesn't have ADD. They hyper-focus and focus incredibly well. But if something isn't interesting, like something you're being taught in school and don't have interest in, like Latin for Einstein, you might be a pretty lousy student because you really can't attend. And because of this disinhibition of this area and the free-floating of thoughts and daydreaming, many people with ADD have this hardwired ability to be more creative, have more out-of-the-box thoughts, have increased number of innovative thoughts, and of those number of thoughts and their awareness of them, which might distract them from something else, but their awareness of them, they often come up with incredible ideas, which is why such a high number of CEOs of companies, in fact, do have attention deficit disorder. It's really quite common.
Well, just to be clear, we're going to take a short break, but just to be clear, before we take the break, we're not saying that every disability and every mental illness is necessarily a gift. We're just saying that there's a great chance that if many people that suffer from one form or another of these disorders or disabilities, oftentimes they have hard wiring for a gift if it's recognized, correct?
Or it might not be recognized,
but
I can explain when we come back is this phenomenon of the U-shaped curve, which indicates to some degree who that has a disability is more likely to exhibit a strength, who is not. And I also want to make it clear that many people who exhibit genius and strengths, of course, have none of these things.
Right.
That a higher incidence of people who do have these things, you are more likely, if you are not severely ill, to have one of these strengths.
Okay. All right. We're speaking with Dr. Gail Saltz. She's a psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst. She has written her latest book is The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. We'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman chatting with Dr. Gail Saltz. She's a psychiatrist, columnist, and author, clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell School of Medicine, and a psychoanalyst with the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. We're discussing her latest book, The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. If you'd like to call in, perhaps you have one of these differences. Our number is 1-800-743-9576. Perhaps your child does. 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. Dr. Saltz, we're going to get to the U-shaped curve and the rest of the things that you mentioned before we went on break, but I just want to say there's such a stigma associated with anything to do with mental illness and disability, learning or otherwise, no matter what it is, be it depression, mild depression, major depression, schizophrenia, anxiety. So I'm thinking the recognition of an illness or deficiency and admitting it exists is a hurdle that has to be overcome first, especially by parents who are embarrassed sometimes if their children are afflicted, but also by adults who are suffering. So how do you address that?
Yeah, this stigma is, I mean, it's incredible. It's 2017. It's still a major, major issue. It is often and on average years between the time a child first presents with symptoms that are, you know, visible to a parent and the time that child gets treatment. And the reason for that isn't the parent necessarily even consciously thinking, oh my gosh, I'm too embarrassed to admit this, but it's sort of not even consciously thinking and trying to say, no, it can't be that, it's not that, until unfortunately years are lost. And as I said to you earlier, you know, the brain, the younger, the earlier the intervention, the more plastic the brain is, the better for the child that you get treatment earlier. In addition, because the brain is plastic, the more something goes on, a symptom, there's something called the kinetic effect, which means basically when you have, say, a depression, that travels along a certain wiring or certain what I'll call a country road, something that's not very developed. But the more often you do it, the more retraced those steps are, the more that wiring is built up until eventually you have a superhighway, meaning it's easier to get more depressions later on if you don't treat it earlier. So it's really important. And yet, as you point out, people feel if their child gets a diagnosis, that means like the beginning of the end, or their child will never amount to anything, or this is a shame on them, and it's devastating, it's upsetting. And of course, for adults, the same. And so people often don't seek treatment because they don't want to acknowledge that there's something going on. And what I hope to help people understand is, A, first of all, close to 50% of Americans will have at some time in their life a mental health diagnosis. So when half of all people are having an issue, it's hard to say, wow, that's a really, you know, abnormal, off-the-charts issue. There is some reason that evolutionarily these things continue to be conferred and passed on generation to generation. And I think a lot of the reason has to do with the fact that these various strengths often come along with it. And what we need to do is start understanding that we all come with somewhat different biology, and if you had, you know, diabetes, you wouldn't say, wow, that's so embarrassing and shameful and like the end of my life, I can't possibly go get my insulin and change my diet. No, you would say, oh, okay, I've got diabetes. I need to do this thing so I can feel better. And I hope that people will understand after reading the book that really so many people struggle with these different things. They do need treatment. Life will be better and feel better if you feel better or your loved one feels better. But at the same time, they need to be searching for what this potential strength is, because as many of the stories make clear that I go over in the book, if you shame a person early on, or if that person feels ashamed, it really robs them of self-esteem, and that in itself can limit where they can go in their career or their ability to make use of their strengths. And so really we want to start early with children understanding that, hey, yes, we want to help you with X, but at the same time, look, you have this very particular strength, and let's develop that, let's hone that, let's use that. Because if you look back in history, and I learned this from doing many-year series at the 92nd Street Y called Psychobiography, which I still do, looking at historic icons who have contributed to awe in every arena, in the arts and sciences and music, everywhere. If you look at the great greats, they almost all had a mental health diagnosis or a learning disability. So if we got rid of all those people, you know, we wouldn't really have any history.
I have to stop you for a second there, because going back in history, you're right. A lot of the great greats did have mental illness or some kind of disability, but there was no medication, there was no psychotherapy, there was no psychiatry, there was none of that. And they manage to do these incredible, to create these incredible things. So the question I want to ask you is, if medication and psychoanalysis or psychotherapy can thwart the creativity of people that have it?
So the answer seems to be, for the vast most part, no. And so there are two things that I need to explain. Yes, they didn't have treatments. And what did that mean? That meant that Vincent van Gogh, for all of his incredible output, suffered horrendously, you know, tried to take his life many times.
Right.
Hemingway ultimately took his life. There was a lot of suffering and loss of quality of life for these people, even as they produced these incredible works. What it seems to be is that one is able to, and this does lead back to the U-shaped curve theory. Which
okay, let's go to that.
Yes. When someone is not ill at all, they are actually less likely to have one of these particular strengths. When someone is mild to moderately ill, they are more likely to have these strengths. And when they are severely ill, they are very unlikely to be able to, it doesn't mean they don't have the strength, but to exhibit the strength, because they're probably so ill, they're very disorganized in their thinking. And so what's important is you want treatment to make you better, you know, that you're basically on the mildest end of the spectrum, or well, it doesn't take away the wiring that permits the ability, except there's one area where people argue about this the most, and it would be with bipolar disorder.
Right, because many manic depressives, or those with bipolar disorder, are only creative when they're manic and don't want to take the medication because they say it does hamper or hinder their creativity.
So here's the thing about bipolar disorder. When you're really creative is definitely during what's called the hypomanic period. So true mania, you have psychotic thinking and you are very ill and you are so disorganized, you might be having brilliant thoughts, but you really can't do anything with them or manifest them. But it is on the way up, let's say, from, you know, normal mood to a high mood, that trajectory where incredible numbers of creative thoughts come. And so people are worried, like they want to stay in that hypomanic period. The reality is you can't stay in that hypomanic period. Nobody does. No one's found a way to just stay mildly hypomanic. You either become manic, which really can destroy your life. I mean, terrible things happen. Or you quickly bottom out into severe depression, and you are definitely not productive during severe depression. So there's no way to stay that way. It's more disruptive to be untreated and have vast periods of either severe depression or mania going on. And for example, the head of bipolar treatment at Tufts University, who is sort of one of the nation's leading people on this, would say this: you want to treat with the smallest dose of medication that one can do to stabilize someone. He finds that they remain definitely more creative than someone who does not have bipolar disorder. They retain 90%, let's say, of their creativity, he would say. And yes, does it take that tiny edge off? It probably does. But the trade-off for not having years lost of horribly disruptive life, you know, losing marriages, losing all your finances, losing many, many things.
Being in the hospital 6 months a year.
Exactly. Being hospitalized, et cetera, is far worth it for that slight edge.
So recognizing these gifts, at times gifts, these illnesses, at times disabilities, whatever it is really up to the parents. But if the parents are in denial, I guess it could be up to teachers when children are young. But are they trained to recognize these kinds of things?
The answer for the most part is no, unfortunately. You know, are there exceptions? Yes, there certainly. I mean, first of all, there are teachers who are really, you know, have been educated and are talented in the whole arena of special education, who may have a lot of insight into this. And there are special teachers who do recognize and step out and really make a difference for a child. But for the most part right now, our educational system is very uniform. It's very based on the idea that everybody should be able to do well at everything. And, you know, every kid should sort of jump through every hoop at the same level. And if they're not, then there's a major problem, and that problem takes them out of the rest of the pack in a negative way. And so I also try to address, because this is really important, that if a teacher does come and say, hey, I see something going on and I am concerned about this, that a parent be willing to say, let's explore this. One helpful thing to do is really to do some neuropsychological testing, which will tell you specifically what the area of relative weakness is so that it can be worked with, but it will also tell you areas of particular strength. And this is important because you, as a parent, you want to be able to come in and say to that educator, hey, you know what, I found out that my child has incredible visual spatial relations, and your project for them to do presented in this way plays only to their weakness. Can we come up with a way for them to do the project and show what they know using their strength? You want to interface with a school because, look, the reality is many kids are what I would call angular learners. They have particular areas of strength and particular areas of weakness, and it's not that you want to ignore the weakness. You know, you want to help them and shore it up a little, but you want to give them the ability to develop and work on a strength that they have, because that's probably the place that's going to carry them in terms of being successful in life.
We're speaking with Dr. Gail Saltz. Her latest book is The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. We need to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to take your calls and your emails. Stay with us. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman, we're visiting with Dr. Gail Saltz. She's a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and her latest book is The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. Let's talk to Jose in Miami first. Welcome, Jose. You're on Topical Currents. Jose?
Hello?
Jose?
Yes.
Yes. Welcome.
Thanks for the show. It's very interesting and enlightening. I would like the doctor to maybe comment on things that I've experienced myself. I've been kind of told that I'm a hypersensitive person, something new that I heard last year, and I'm in my 50s, and I've had like three major depressions in my life, and I'm like a high IQ with two masters and 4.0 GPAs, but I'm kind of not performing to my full potential. I'm creative, but just like I noticed there is a relationship between that hypersensitive and, you know, being affected emotionally to the reality of the world and life.
Hmm.
Therefore, the depressions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jose. And are you going to take your... Okay.
Yes.
I guess, Jose.
Yes. So, you know, recurrent depression. So one thing that departs a little bit in depression from some of the other issues is that often when someone is in the depths of depression, it part of the symptomology is to be sort of not doing anything. You know, there are symptoms like having your thinking literally be slowed, and even your body movement slowed down, and the ability to plan and be productive is really hampered by actual depression. So it is, first of all, really important to treat depression as soon as it strikes. And if you've had it a few times, you pretty much know when you're heading down that path. It's also important to, in between those times, you know, stay with someone if you can to do some therapy and some preventive kinds of measures to keep yourself from falling into depression again. So things like exercise very regularly, aerobic, you know, intense exercise multiple times a week is helpful. Certain, you know, learning certain coping skills for things that maybe you do feel sensitive about or that potentially can bother you. And understanding recurrent patterns of behavior that are maybe like maladaptive and not working for you. So all of that in the treatment department is really important in terms of being productive when you have depression. But the strengths of someone with depression tend to be particularly being empathic. The experience of suffering in that way often makes you very attuned to other people's suffering. Being particularly insightful, having what I would describe as realism. So people who don't have depression actually see the world a little sunnier than it probably actually is. It's our day-to-day coping mechanism. People who tend toward depression tend to see the world not negatively, unless they're actually in the moment of depression, but in a more realistic, true sort of sense. They tend to have more obsessiveness and perfectionism. And, you know, so think Abraham Lincoln, right? One of the greatest presidents of all time, at the top of the list always, suffered from recurrent major depression, clearly, was suicidal multiple times in his life. Clearly, his realism, his empathy, his ability to see what was coming vis-a-vis the Civil War, to pull people together, his choice of cause, of slavery, et cetera, being very informed by being an empathic and insightful person, and being a perfectionist in organizing and doing what needed to be done. And these are things that you should think about in terms of turning them to areas of interest for you, and looking to apply them. Some people find it very helpful, as I said earlier, to get neuropsych testing, even as an adult, to see what their very particular strengths lean toward so that they can sort of hone in and make use of those things.
Who does
and
that kind people, of testing?
Oh, there are educational psychologists that do neuropsych testing.
Neuropsych testing, okay.
Neuropsychological testing, yes. And there are, and when once you have that information, they often can guide you in terms of areas, careers, tasks that utilize the particular strengths that work for you.
Okay, let's speak to Dane in Deerfield Beach. Welcome, Dane.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
I've actually taught mathematics in South Florida for, close to 15 years, I guess, and at the university level, high school level prior to that, briefly, and I tutored throughout college. And, you know, I've seen that, what she's talking about, the strengths that students with diagnosed learning disabilities have. And I was curious if she has any thoughts after going through this research about the accommodations that are granted to students at both high schools and universities when they have learning disabilities. For example, the ADHD idea that you said that sometimes they have ability to hyperfocus. And I wonder if during a testing situation, if they are under stress, they're able to hyperfocus, or maybe the opposite occurs. I don't know. But the general idea is, could it be that maybe that needs to be looked at more carefully, because perhaps, you know, while students have disadvantages, they also have advantages, and maybe the current accommodations are sort of not appropriate for each situation, because they're generally just given quiet testing environment.
That's actually a really good question, and,
yeah,
and something that I hope as time moves on will be looked at. One problem in terms of looking at this is, you know, as you know, all research takes money, and we tend not to spend dollars researching things that are considered good. we're very problem focused, and there aren't enough dollars to go around. So understood that, you know, NIMH and, you know, the tendency is to channel dollars into research that looks at pathology and how do we deal with that pathology. And so the idea that there's been very, the reason I wrote this is try to cull the new and small amounts of research that have been done in this area of this link between disorder and ability. But you're right in a way that we're shooting a fly with a cannonball. It's sort of the only thing we have to offer really is more time, you know, extra time. Sometimes extra time really is the appropriate choice, no question. I mean, if someone is, you know, has a learning issue that causes them to be a particularly slow reader, as in the case of dyslexia. In the case of attention deficit disorder, you know, it is a big term that means a number of different things, and people have different looking constellations of this presentation. So some people have more of the agitation, restlessness, they have hyperactivity, in other words, involved. Some people have more of the impulsivity. Some people have more of the difficulty with concentrating. The problem with test taking is that, you know, unless it happens to be a test about something that is tremendously rewarding and fascinating, no, they're not going to hyperfocus on that test. And that makes test taking very difficult for somebody with ADD unless they're medicated. And, you know, as you probably know, if you've seen a lot of these students, you know, a number of them certainly will get medication that allows them to focus perhaps at the same level that somebody who doesn't have ADD can focus, but they still might be getting extra time. So it just, the problem is it kind of will need to be done on a case-by-case basis, and there's still a lot of information that we don't have. So at this point, there are so many things that create difficulty in taking a test for someone who has an attentional issue and can't regulate that they are attending, that they turn off their impulsive behavior and, their impulses in general, or that they might have physical agitation, not to mention the high anxiety that often comes along for kids with ADD because they have a knowledge of these things being a problem for them, and yet they're under a timetable.
Okay, Dane, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Okay, and let's move along to Shauna in Lake Worth. Shauna, good afternoon.
Yeah, I had a question. So my question is, do you think that, say, forcing a kid who's dyslexic or has ADD to be a normal learner could lead them down the path for, say, lifelong depression later, that not addressing it in a positive way to use their strengths would put mm-hmm. them on a path to possible depression, changing their neurochemistry in those early years.
So, it's an interesting question in the sense that we do know, for example, that if you've been bullied as a child, you have a higher likelihood of suffering depression, depressive disorder or anxiety disorder as an adult. And we do know that if you, if traumatic ongoings, let's say, so an injury to self-esteem can definitely be that. Other kids might say, "Whoa, you're not the smart one, or you have a real problem," or be exclusionary in some way that's really hurts a child. A teacher may, also hurt a child in communicating. You're not capable. You're not going to amount to something. You've got a real problem. Or a parent may communicate that, and so of course, something that is deeply injurious to self-esteem only certainly could predispose someone to struggling off and on with depression. Will it look like the same depression exactly as someone who has a biologic predisposition to recurrent major depression? Probably not. It might look more like someone we would call dysthymia, having sort of mild to moderate depression kind of all the time, just feeling not good about themselves. Treatment can be extremely helpful for that. It really can. I want to say that. But I also want to say that part of the reason I wrote this book is because really what you're talking about is, does stigmatizing a child hurt them in the long run? And the answer is yes. And I really hope to sort of move the needle for parents, for educators, for our society at large to think about the fact that they are really missing part of the picture. And that if a child is informed, hey, everybody has relative weaknesses, and that's true, and everybody has relative strengths, and that is true, and your relative weakness is this, and we don't want to ignore it because we want to help you with it, because if you have dyslexia, it's still important that we help you to be able to read because it's a reading world. Or, if you have ADD, we want to be able to give you coping tools so that you can, to the best of your ability, stay organized, not do impulsive things that hurt you or hurt others, and be able to learn in school. So that's important. But at the same time, you have these relative strengths, and they are phenomenal. And we want to help you to develop those and play to those, because those are the things that are going to help you be a successful person. And of course,
Want to speak to your the value of the early testing in that area, because I know for my children, they were both late readers. And when I had them tested, it turned out that they had auditory issues. And so, from my generation, what was I trying to do to teach them to read? Using phonics, which was like absolutely the wrong way to go about it.
Yeah,
for
right,
a kid with auditory issues.
Yeah, so valuable, right? Because also, a teacher, if you know now early on, right, that your kid has some auditory issues, being able to inform the educator, hey, whenever possible, my child, this really would help. My child needs it in this visual form so they can refer back to it, as opposed to, they only heard it, now it's you didn't present it anymore.
And later in life, I have to say that I encouraged my kids to write things down. You're not going to remember it if you don't write it down.
Yep. Okay, Shauna, we're going to have to move on because we have lots of calls, okay?
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much. And we are speaking with Dr. Gail Saltz. Her latest book is The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. Let's talk to Laz in Miami about the neuropsychological exams. Hi, Laz.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to share, I'm 44 years old, and it was 4 years ago that I had a neuropsychological exam. And in summary, I always had a high IQ, tested well, but teachers would always say, oh, he can't get himself together. He's too hyperactive. We went to a doctor, or I was given ADD medication, or another one would say he needs bipolar medication. However, after this neuropsych exam, I discovered that my photographic, or I guess the doctor would know, visual memory didn't exist. I mean, I would see people and I would never, a week later, I wouldn't remember their name and a few other deficits. And thankfully, I have a great doctor at UM, Dr. Renee Hernandez. And so you can teach a dog new tricks. I didn't even know that I could write with my right hand and somewhat with my left hand. It's something that we, discovered. And I just wish that, these tests were available and in more detail 30 years ago. And now I take ADD meds and I take a bipolar medication. And unlike 30 years of where these deficits affected my personal relationships and my professional relationships significantly, now I know I'm not really a very smart failure. And I just want to suggest any parent that sees any types of similar issue that they should go to and get their child tested. I discovered that I can, if I go back to college, that I even qualify to have somebody take notes for me. And I think your doctor will probably be able to detail that. But it's a great show, and thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Sure.
Dr. Saltz, something I'm thinking after just hearing Laz, and I know this is often the case. So let's say the parents have trouble with a diagnosis or are in denial about it. Let's say the teachers aren't trained enough and don't recognize it. And let's say somehow this person gets to a doctor and the doctors often disagree about the diagnosis. It's a little confusing. Like, he was told he was ADD. Yes. He was told he was bipolar. Yes.
the reason that unfortunately happens more often than anybody would wish is because, and it's the reason that I broke the book down by symptom and not by diagnosis, is because many diagnoses have similar symptoms in them, or they can look similar. And because there's a great deal of what's called comorbidity, meaning a person who has one diagnosis is more likely to have another diagnosis. So obviously, there's something different going on with the wiring that is, resulting in this. And that's why it can make the picture very confusing. And also, we as a profession are going to increasingly need to be moving in this direction of symptom-focused understanding of brain structure and function. And that is starting to happen. There's a project ongoing right now that was initiated by the Obama administration, the Brain Initiative, called the Connectome Project, where they're doing MRIs of like 12,000, quote, normal subjects in their brains.
How do you spell that?
Connectome.
As in connect? Tome?
Yes, as in connect.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
And the idea is that we don't even have a map of what we're calling normal brains. So we can't very well, understand what differences are if we don't have just, this is what it looks like. And what's turning, and this is why I say, it's turning out to be, and it's going to turn out to be, that there's a lot of variation in brains in general. And this is important to understand, and we have to start targeting symptoms by looking at structure this way, as opposed to our current system which we're using right now, which, because we don't have anything better, which is the diagnostic and statistical manual.
Right, which is a hindrance to all this, to everything you're saying.
It's a help in the way that right now we don't have something else, and we have to be able to talk to insurance companies about reimbursement, and we have to talk to others about in shorthand to each other and understand that this means something about, for example, the prognosis here or what the person's struggling with. It's a way of doing that and thinking about things, but it is clearly not going to – I don't think it will be the future of the way we look at these things. It's just that, you know, neuroscience and psychiatry, in a weird way, more than other fields of medicine, is still more in its infancy than many other areas. Because why? The brain's the most complicated organ. And, you know, as our last commenter said, 30 years ago, we didn't even have, you know, the things that we have now, which are still right. more rudimentary than we need.
Let's speak to Thomas. He's been waiting a very long time. And, Thomas, we're near the end of the show. So if you could talk to Dr. Saltz.
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me. Dr. Saltz, I had a question in regards to personality types. I'm a freshman, I just finished my freshman year in college, and I went through a kind of a depressive episode due to, like, I just wasn't vibing right with the environment and all that, and I took an MBTI personality exam, and I discovered that I was INTP, and so I started researching.
What does that stand for?
INTP, that's, I believe you, it's introversion, intuition, thinking, and then P, I forgot what the P stands for, but I found that a lot of people with my similar personality type, my similar mental framework, were more prone to depression. And so I was wondering if, like, what would be the best kind of techniques or treatments in order to combat this depression, in order to, you know, like, keep our kind of thought process going.
Yeah. So, you know, the sad reality is that the number of college students presenting with depression and anxiety is definitely growing, and colleges are unfortunately very understaffed in the mental health arena. So you may have to step outside school into your community for treatment, and I would recommend treatment. It is a difficult, is a stressful time of life. Your first time on your own, figuring out everything, and if you are an introvert, which is not a bad thing, it simply means you gain more of your energy from turning inward on your own thoughts, and you need that time. And colleges, as you know, tends to be, right. You know, people are very focused on, like, where's the party? And, like, everything is supposed to be about outside yourself, and you don't gain your, you know, that drains you a bit, you know, if you're an introvert, and you need some of that alone time, and that's okay. So you have to know that about yourself, and that has to be okay on the one hand. And on the other hand, I would say early 20s is a difficult it is an unusual time. It is a big developmental time. If you are having some struggles, it's not, there's nothing wrong with your personality type. You just need to learn some more things about who you are and what will help you to maintain, you know, feeling less anxious and, you know, more stable mood during that time, which may have to do with de-stressing things like recurrent exercise of certain sorts, but also what are the things that you can turn inward to yourself that help you to regain a comfort and a sense of self. So that might be writing, it might be music, it might be, I mean, you will have to explore about yourself, but I would highly recommend psychotherapy, and it doesn't have to be, you know, anything psychodynamic, like exploratory, to understand better about yourself.
Okay, Thomas.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks for calling. And Ray has been waiting a long time, Ray, but we are just about, you have about, sorry to say, just a few seconds, but if you want to go ahead, you can.
Yeah, no, thank you. I actually have I have a whole bunch of questions, but I'll narrow it down to one. I'm going to be turning 50, and I just wanted to ask Dr. Saltz, is it too late? Too late to find a way to change my life? It's been a roller coaster ride.
Okay, go ahead, Dr. Saltz.
I will simply say this. The brain remains plastic through life. Yes, less so as we age, but it certainly at 50, it is still plastic. Is it possible to find a new interest, a new passion? Is it possible to take what you're doing and morph it, move it in that direction? Absolutely not too late. I would highly suggest testing is one way to think about it, neuropsych testing, but also really for many people who feel like they just have regret and are not where they want to be, psychotherapy can be very useful for that. That tends to be, again, a more psychodynamically oriented psychotherapy, a more thought, not a cognitive kind of therapy, but more of a thought-based therapy.
Okay, Ray, we wish you the best.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we're out of time. We apologize to the callers, to the emailers that we didn't get to. We've been speaking with Dr. Gail Saltz. She's a psychiatrist, columnist, and author, clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the New York Presbyterian Hospital Weill Cornell School of Medicine, and a psychoanalyst with the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. Her latest book is The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. Thank you so much, Dr. Saltz.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. And that wraps up today's edition of Topical Currents. Thank you so much for joining us. It was produced by Richard Ives with technical direction from our online producer, Jason Zapka. Polly Landis is associate producer. You can download or link each program from our website at WLRN.org. There's also the iTunes podcast of each program. Also, there's more information at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow, we hope you'll join us for our popular restaurant roundabout with chef and author Linda Gassenheimer. We'll have restaurant reviewers on hand and talk about the many new restaurant openings and closings and ask you about your favorites. Bonnie Berman for Joseph Cooper. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.